mortgage capital markets decisions carry real financial consequences. That's why Optimal Blue commissioned an independent ROI study with MarketWise advisors, analyzing results across hundreds of lenders. The study highlights consistent gains in efficiency, accuracy, and financial performance, including an average $1,006 net benefit per loan. To be notified when the full 2026 Optimal Blue ROI study is released in May, sign up at optimalblue.com/2026-study.
Welcome to Optimal Insights. I'm your host, Jim Glennon, Senior Vice President of Hedging and Trading Operations at Optimal Blue. Our clients and industry partners have long relied on Optimal Blue for trusted insights and commentary, and these podcasts are an evolution of our commitment to keeping the industry informed. Let's dive into today's episode.
Welcome to Optimal Insights, your weekly source for real-time rate data and expert capital markets commentary, brought to you by Optimal Blue. Let's dive in and help you maximize your profitability this week.
Hi, welcome everybody. Thanks for being here. We have a great show as always for you today. In the interest of making sure that you know what to watch, whether you're an originator, a capital markets person, or just someone interested in the mortgage industry and some great commentary, keep listening. We'll do a market update here in a little bit with Alex and James. Of course, a ton to talk about. We got the Fed meeting coming up this week. There's some happenings over the weekend. We'll touch a bit on the conflict in the Middle East and then some interesting economic releases coming out as well. And we'll even preview a little bit of the unemployment report coming out next week. After that, we have a special guest, industry luminary Jeremy Shires will be joining us from Westgate Bank. We'll talk through some issues that are sort of flying under the radar right now in terms of laws and regulation around our industry. There's obviously a ton going on geopolitically and other things going on in the news. So we will spend a little time just focused on what's going on in our industry. First, in the way of data, we have the OBMMI at roughly 6.25% right now, so a little higher than we'd like to see it, higher than that five handle that we were seeing late last year. The 10-year Treasury is at 4.33, so still seeing a little bit of compression in the spread between mortgages and Treasuries, but still would like to see both of those numbers a little bit lower. All right, let's go check in with James and Alex to see what's going on in the market. Alex and James, welcome. Excited to talk to you today. I have a few things in the news, some of them kind of scary things, but some of them potentially encouraging. Yeah, I mean, we're, you know, not much of a market reaction to the security breach at the correspondents' dinner over the weekend, but that was big news. I believe that was Saturday night. That was kind of scary. Hopefully you all saw that. If not, take a look at the news roundup on Sunday morning. But yeah, James was just telling me here that we were kind of contemplating what the succession plan would have been had, you know, God forbid that had gone a lot worse. And Grassley, I believe you said, would be running the government today had there been a horrific end to that situation.
The next in charge who wasn't in that room. So if something, again, as you said, really horrific had happened, it's like 94-year-old Democratic Senator Chuck Grassley would have been in charge. So we would have had the oldest president ever again, and he, you know, would have beat it out by like a decade. So that would have been definitely more of that. But luckily, Secret Service did catch the runner.
Yeah, did an amazing job. Thank goodness it worked out the way it did, but yeah, that would have been, we'd be looking at a completely different world had that gone differently. So that is kind of sobering. No market reaction to that seemingly, but I don't know. In the way of geopolitics, is there really anything notable today in the way of the war? I mean, there's more, it's just more kind of hearsay of possible discussions about reopening the strait, ending the war, but I don't know. Oil's up again. So I feel like if you're following the money, there's almost no credibility to any of this talk over the weekend.
Yeah, we headed into the weekend looking a bit better. It sounded, there were rumors that Jared Kushner and Steve Witkoff headed back to Pakistan for a second round of potential peace talks. And then I think it was Saturday sometime it was announced that those were canceled. So that's led to the run-up in oil we've seen. But really, there hasn't been any change the situation from last week. The fighting is not active on the Iran-US front. There's some skirmishes between Israel and Lebanon, or rather Hezbollah in Lebanon. But from a U.S. markets perspective, it's steady as it goes in regards to just waiting for some peace talks to develop. Then as of right now, there's nothing on the books.
All right. So we'll keep you apprised Obviously, we'll probably have a bonus cast if something big happens. But I don't know. What do you think, James? What's the best case scenario? What are we looking forward to right now with the war in the Middle East?
Well, they'll move forward, right? They'll be negotiating by phone, which that sounds a lot like some will they, won't they romances that I've seen people have in their lives. And those have been less on and off than this. It seems like we're going to be stuck here for a while, which is not good news for anyone. Gas prices nationally, it's about $4.10. California and the West Coast are worse than that. The middle of the country is doing better. They're in the mid 3.5s, but still it's up quite a bit from this time 2 months ago. No real end in sight.
Yeah. Yeah. Still almost completely choked off more than 20% of the world's oil or energy, you know, unable to make it through the Strait. I know, you know, Denver's a little bit insulated. We have a refinery here. We actually drove by it the other day and my wife was, you know, kind of regretting the smell that the refinery makes when you drive by. But I said that, you know, that smell's got to be good right now. I think it's a reason why our gas is about a buck cheaper than it is anywhere else. And I believe our energy exports are also up, which, I mean, weird kind of positive side effect. Because we do have, you know, produce relatively large amount of energy given the population of our country. It's probably not sustainable in the long run, especially when you get into the different types of oil that are traded around the world, the type that we produce versus the type that we refine. But nonetheless, again, we're a bit insulated, not just geographically, but also in terms of the energy crisis that's going to hit Europe here pretty hard in the very near future, I think.
Agreed. Yeah, I don't know if we talked about it last week, but there's been rerouting of ships that have been waiting to enter the Strait of Hormuz all this time, the past 8 weeks or so. Those have been rerouted towards Gulf ports here in the U.S. So, yeah, it'll put more demand on U.S. exporters, or we are a net energy exporter at the end of the day. But at the same time, from everything I've read, it doesn't seem that the U.S. oil majors are pumping at full capacity right now either. So there's probably still a little bit of supply to unlock. But they're taking their profits right now.
Yeah. I mean, that's, you can kind of name your price in a market like this, right? As long as this disruption continues, we'll probably continue to see oil prices go up, and that will encourage more capacity coming online, right? It just encourage more production as long as, especially if, you know, these huge oil tankers are coming into the Gulf and they're, you know, they're hungry for it. All right. What did we get in the way of releases last week? Any numbers that we should be focusing on here? Maybe not just numbers. I think, James, you had a couple interesting factoids from the BBC.
Yeah. I mean, you know, the only real number from last week was consumer sentiment being revised. It was pushed up to 49.8. It was 47.6. That's still the lowest it's ever been recorded, but we are at war and there is an oil crisis. So it makes some sense that should be a little scanty as a number. That's the only real big release from last week. But I do have, you know, unless you're a big Beatles fan and you saw Ringo Starr released his latest album, The Long, Long Road. So that's a major release from last week from my end.
it's pretty important, especially for the folks across the pond there. I think that's worth noting. I mean, how old that guy's got to be? He's got to be almost as old as Grassley at this point. He's churning out, you know, his 22nd album. That's pretty impressive.
He should run for Senate.
This week, we've got a few things this week. We've been talking about the Fed. We do have the Fed meeting coming up on Wednesday. I mean, roundly expected to be kind of a nothing event, I think, other than it almost certainly at this point being Jerome Powell's final meeting as the chair of the Fed. No rate cut or rate hike expected. Maybe a change in language, hopefully something around how the Fed is viewing energy prices and just general economics around the war. But anything else y'all think we should be paying attention to in this FOMC announcement on Wednesday and subsequent press conference?
My only thing I'm looking for is in the press conference, seeing Powell likely continuing to pivot the narrative towards a focus on inflation as he did it is at the last meeting. And we were choking after the last meeting about how inflation was running higher than they would have liked it to, and they didn't get it down to where they would have liked it to, which was an admission that was many years probably in the making. But yeah, this is Powell's final, likely, much more likely final meeting. We got the DOJ dropped the charges against Powell, which was the kind of self-imposed hurdle that the Trump administration has put themselves in at this point, wherein Powell's being investigated. Senator Tillis, who's on the Senate Banking Committee, said he wouldn't allow any of Powell's successor candidates to be passed through the committee until that case was resolved. The case has now been resolved. It was dropped. So I don't see any reason that we won't see a Warsh confirmation at this point.
Right. Yeah, that's huge news. That was hanging out there for a while, and folks are kind of wondering what gives. Like, somebody has to back off, or Powell sits in office, or the White House figures out a way to fire him, or whatever, you know, which just seems like a big old distraction that nobody really needed. So thankfully that those charges, criminal charges against Jerome Powell were dropped. So yeah, it will be his last conference almost certainly. Yeah, you almost wonder though, that maybe he does have some final words. It's been a pretty long tenure for him. He's been a little more open, a little more candid in these last couple meetings. Maybe he gets extra candid. Maybe it would be interesting and possible a little bit of drama there in his, you know, the way that maybe an outgoing president might have words for the nation, just words, whether it's words of caution or with the inflation thing, it sounded like words of regret almost, like we kind of almost admitting that we could have done a lot better than we did. Anyway, it'll be worth a watch.
Absolutely. Absolutely. But yeah, from the rate front, we're expected to sit at the current free market rate for a good while here. So no change expected there.
Otherwise, we do have PCE coming out. Coincidentally, the day after the meeting, and that is the Fed's preferred inflation metric. It's expected to be up, obviously, like every other inflation metric right now, mostly because of energy, right? I think the year-over-year expectation is 3.5, well above the Fed's mandate, yet we probably still won't see a rate increase because I believe the Fed would still consider this type of inflation to be transient, which is a word they got in trouble. They probably won't use again because of some of the jokes around it from the previous bout of inflation that we had after COVID.
Yeah. Transient and largely supply driven, supply side shock driven. There's really nothing they can do about a shortage of oil. You know, they can hike rates, but that's just going to cause more damage to the economy than what we're already feeling from that, mm-hmm. that oil shortage. So they kind of have to sit on their hands in a situation like this.
Mm-hmm. All right, so watch for that number Thursday, and then Kevin Foley's favorite number also comes out on Wednesday. We will get quarter one GDP. Sorry, that's Thursday, I think. Quarter one GDP, which, yeah, Kevin has kind of pinned as a throwaway number just due to a lot of dynamics around things like seasonal adjustments and holiday spending and this sort of thing. But nonetheless, that's coming out. We've been pretty good at triangulating GDP. GDP is rarely ever a surprising number, right? And that's one of the other reasons I think that people don't like to look at it too closely unless there's a major deviation, because you can kind of get there with a lot of other releases that come out pre-GDP. Is that right? Is that how y'all would look at GDP these days?
I agree. It's also, it's difficult to translate GDP as a headline number into what it means for the average citizen, right? Like, per capita GDP is a little bit more telling. We're all producing $150,000, $200,000 worth of stuff every year, sure. But that GDP number is driven by imports and exports a lot right now. So, you know, what does that have to do with you working your 9 to 5? It's the number could be really high or really low, and it's not very reflective of how the average citizen is doing. It's a little bit of a more and more of a washed out number right now.
Right. Yeah, unless it's negative for multiple quarters in a row, right? Then you can say that we're in a recession or that the economy is shrinking. But otherwise, it's, yeah, how much does the average American care about how quickly the economy is growing? Because you can get that from a lot of other things like company earnings, which are, we're getting a deluge of that right now, which is pretty interesting. Just seeing the pretty significant increase in earnings like across the board in corporate America has been pretty, I guess, encouraging. You know, that it's almost as if, I don't know if it's the kind of the after effects of inflation or, you know, you look at the big banks, it's a lot of just a ton of trading going on, whether the market's up or market's down, just a lot of trading activity, just revenues are up, earnings are up. Some of that's attributable to AI, but it seems very unlikely that that's a major contributor right now. Just, I don't know, corporate America just seems to be happy at the moment. Again, how does that translate, you know, to us average Joes? Hard to say, but it does feel like, you know, the stock market gains that we've seen over the last few years are potentially coming true, at least so far.
Yeah, agreed. No, if you're looking at earnings, the picture looks pretty strong. Margins are strong. And this week will, if you're keeping anything on your radar, a number of the big tech companies are all reporting on Wednesday. Google, Meta, the ones with massive AI capex, which is going to be a good metric for the equities markets for sure, since they tend to be the front runners.
Yeah, right back to betting on the Magnificent Seven or whatever you want to call them, right? Big tech, big banks. So looking forward to that. I guess the downside of that for our industry is it becomes less likely that we see lower rates in the near term. We're still bouncing around 6.25% for a 30-year mortgage, which is not the best. But nonetheless, we're seeing decent volume continuing to come through, even with that elevated rate. We're just seeing the new normal start to pick up speed where, you know, whether it's life changes or just different dynamics in the market, the purchase, you know, market right now for homes is pretty healthy. And seeing, you know, supply continue to creep up. Seeing people, like I read the other day that rent is finally kind of cooperating, and from a renter's perspective, rent is kind of flat year over year, which means that wages have slightly outpaced rent. That was, you know, increases in rent was a saga for many years, that it was just getting more and more expensive to buy or to rent a home or to rent an apartment. But there's been just a ton of supply that's come online by way of new build apartment buildings, but also you can read into it that some homeowners are choosing to buy a new home and rent out their old home. There's a increasing number of those. So keep that 3% interest rate on your rental property, spend 6.25% on your new property. Again, adding to that supply of homes for rent. So that was, I think that's a welcome development, especially for inflation numbers, for our industry, just for activity. Just thought that was interesting that the homeownership / rent market just continues to reshape itself or reinvent itself, right? And it's just different every month when you look at it differently. That ties it up. Anything else, gentlemen, you'd want to cover here this week?
Just looking ahead to next week, it's we'll have the unemployment report next Friday. And throughout the week, we'll see new home sales and construction spending. So just a little bit of building sale color and then leading into unemployment.
Very good. Yeah, we'll cover the unemployment report or give kind of a preview to that this coming Monday. Good call there. Yeah, it'll be on the 8th of May. I cannot believe we're already talking about May, but we'll see if, you know, if the employment picture has changed at all due to, you know, inflation from the war. It seems a little bit premature for there to be any effects there, but still, the labor market is another that keeps reinventing itself every month. So we'll learn more about that going into next week. All right, gentlemen, as always, great discussion. Thanks for being here and we'll talk again next week. All right. Alex and I have a rare treat for you all today. We've been talking with our friend and our client, Jeremy Shires. Jeremy is the executive vice president and president of mortgage at Westgate Bank, as well as the chairman of the Secondary and Capital Markets Committee of the MBA, and just a general overall industry advocate that we work with and that does a lot to better our industry Jeremy's been out there learning, monitoring, and advocating for the mortgage industry. So we thought it would be good to have him on the podcast to school us on some relevant happenings in the government that affect the housing and mortgage industries. So welcome, Jeremy. Thanks for being here today.
Gentlemen, I appreciate being on the program.
So Alex, why don't you kick it off? You know, we've got a lot of questions for you. We want to kind of prioritize in our brains what we should be paying attention to, because, you know, you've got the war in Iran, you've got energy prices, you've got drama with the Fed, you have an assassination attempt again, but there's a lot of stuff going on that directly affects our industry that we want to at least take some time to focus on. And we want to kind of weed through that, some of that with you to prioritize that for our own education. So go ahead, Alex.
Absolutely. Thank you for being here, Jeremy. You know, I'm going to start us off with a little appetizer here. It might sound dense to begin with, but just talking about some executive orders that were signed. I believe it was late last month in March in regards to regulatory burden and access to credit. Could you run me through just what they're seeking to achieve with these, in addition to how on the ground it's looking to be achieved?
Yeah, so the executive orders are really focused around trying to pave the way to make the home buying and home building process easier in the country. Without the executive order, there are few reasons that the regulatory agencies have that allow them to open rules up for rulemaking and modification. Some of those rules are out there that allow them to make those changes, AGRIPA, economic, you know, incentive, the Paper Reduction Act, some of those things allow them about every 10 years to reopen a rule and look. The executive order allows them to open these up sooner in the process, allows them to get started faster. And it's extremely broad-based. So this impacts the way the executive orders wrote, impacts everybody from the Securities Exchange Commission to the bank regulatory agencies to the CFPB, kind of all the way up and down the line, soup to nuts. Anything that could potentially touch housing or housing finance is kind of lumped into this.
You were saying before the call that actually these executive orders, and you just hinted at just there, they're extremely broad. Is that correct?
Right. Yeah. The breadth that they have really creates a little bit of a challenge from an advocacy standpoint over what do we ask for first? So we're trying to pick our spots in what are the things that we're asking the regulatory agencies to touch? What are the things that are going to be the most meaningful, the most impactful, while understanding the timelines and time constraints? The rules, when it comes to doing these things, they have to go through a proposed rule and then get comment. And then after the comment, they issue a final rule. And all of that takes time to work through. Sometimes prior to rulemaking, they have to do a request for information. So those RFIs take time. So these things are things that just because the president issued an executive order doesn't mean something changes tomorrow. And in fact, in a meeting I was at a couple of weeks ago, we were talking with some representatives from the CFPB, and they were expressing their earnest interest in focusing on rules that they could change, that could be impactful, that could be finalized and be durable during the remaining term of this administration. That means that they want things that can withstand the Congressional Review Act. They want the process to be buttoned down so it can withstand lawsuits, potentially alleging violations of the Administrative Procedures Act. You may have heard those be called arbitrary and capricious. So those are things that are very aware of. There's also things that, as an industry, we have to be aware of if we're going to ask them to make changes. If there are changes made to TRID, for example, if it impacts the forms, the loan estimate or the closing disclosure, those model forms from a regulatory process take 3 to 5 years to get finalized to make changes. So the CFPB was very hesitant to do anything that would make a change to a form because they can't guarantee it can be done in time to be wrapped up during the current administration.
So what's the worry there that if it drags on into the next administration, that these efforts would just be killed anyway? So the the 2.5 years worth of work would just be kind of useless.
Right. And to give an example, and we can talk about the fallout from it later, if you recall, in the last year of the previous administration, the Biden administration, there was a set of published bank capital rules known as Basel III Endgame. Basel III Endgame was not going to be friendly to the mortgage market. It was not going to be friendly to banks and mortgage. And it got a big enough backlash from the industry that the regulatory agencies did not quickly push to finalize it. And almost immediately, the current administration rolled it back and took it off the table. So carryovers like that can easily be pulled off very quickly, no matter how good or bad we think it is from an industry standpoint to do so. So, you know, that they're really focused on what can they accomplish in the next less than 3 years to be truly functional about it, because they want to get this thing, these things done in a way that they're durable.
Right. So a lot of decision making to be done and way too many things to accomplish without some heavy discussions around prioritization, right? Because as you said, the executive orders are extremely broad. So CFPB and others really have to pick and choose what they want to focus on. And not just because there's so many options, but also because they have to decide on what's going to be durable, what's actually going to, can they get done and is going to withstand all the reviews through Congress and the chambers.
Right. Yeah. This thing is broad enough that it is very much like walking up to an all-you-can-eat buffet. And even if I really like a type of pudding, I might skip that in order to take the steak. And that's really the prioritization that as an industry, we have to help the regulatory agencies identify what's pudding and what's steak. And we may have to understand that we don't have time to eat the steak. We might have to take the chicken.
Right. Great analogy. Yeah, that definitely is helpful. Yeah. As always, it's one thing to throw an executive order out there. It's another thing to actually have it have some sort of effect on anything. And in this case, our industry.
Yeah. And let's say that things continue apace. They get through the review process and these new rules are put into place. What sort of timeline would we be looking at in a, you know, glass half full scenario?
Glass half full. If some of the industry groups are able to provide some template model language to some of these regulatory agencies to jumpstart their thought leadership around how to change some of these regs, that would get us to propose rules faster. So I wouldn't look for anything to go from a proposed rule and ultimately a final rule until we get into sometime in 2027 is when we would start seeing some rules go final, some changes occurring. But as many things as the president has called for in the executive order to be looked at, I would expect that, you know, there's going to be changes going all the way into 2028, and they'll focus to try to get those finalized within the first half of 28. So that way they're more easily can withstand Congressional Review Act. Should the election go against the current regulatory agencies, as far as who's the party in power in the White House and in on the Hill, that's kind of where I would look at the timeline. You're not going to see any meaningful changes probably for the rest of 26, but as you get into 27 and into 28, you'll start seeing things come together at pace.
Good to know. Good to know. No, that's a good timeline, but they need to stick to that timeline, because as you said, once we're into the latter half of 28,
election time. Some,
yes. Yes.
Yeah. I mean, again, glass half full, just to tie a bow on it with the executive orders, high level, we're just looking to hopefully see less regulation, right? Less capital requirements, better access to credit. So, I mean, that's what it means to the borrower and to the originator in our industry, right? That's kind of what all these things come together to hopefully provide.
Right. And a number of things that are in the EO that ultimately we believe have the best chances of being durable and being able to be implemented in a fairly short period of time are things that can lower costs to borrowers, families that are trying to buy homes. And while they might not seem like much individually, Some of these regulations are death by a thousand paper cuts. You know, you start stacking one operational thing on top of the next. So things like simplification and changes to the enforcement side of HMDA is an example. You know, there's a lot of originators spend a lot of money to get HMDA compliance correct. And if you've ever been through a compliance exam and your HMDA LAR wasn't accurate, you will gladly spend whatever money is necessary to make it accurate, because it's not a fun process. Things around TRID, tolerance cures, and whether or not we can make sure that the appropriate parties wind up paying the costs for their transactions. So that way we don't have to charge all families for an oops on somebody's particular transaction that was not standard. Sometimes you see, and oftentimes you'll see, purchase agreements have something buried in an addendum somewhere. And that's usually where some of the biggest tolerance cures come from. And those are just things that are hard to find at the time that you do the disclosures on the initial LE, on that loan estimate. And as an institution, you're stuck with that problem. And so you have to charge everybody else to make it up. We think that should be more forgiving. Some things that could be done in regulation are around ability to repay and the qualified mortgage. And should non-government guaranteed loans be allowed to have some level of ability to do a streamlined refinance? Is the fact that you've been making your mortgage payment for the last 36 months on time, every time, sufficient to say that you have the ability to repay, and therefore we can do a streamlined refinance for you without having to re-verify income, re-verify credit, and go through the whole process? Potentially. Today, nobody gets to make that decision because the CFPB's ability to repay and QM rules disallow it. So again, that's something that's out there. And maybe if they get time, they'll get to some changes to LO compensation that will allow loan officers to lower their compensation in order to compete on the marketplace. So that way they don't lose a transaction just because, you know, the XYZ lender down the street is offering a little better rate today because rates moved down over the last 2 weeks. We think that's important to have. It also would allow lenders that are currently not participating in first-time homebuyer programs to come back into those, because so often those first-time homebuyer programs are not highly enough compensated for the originator in order to make it make sense for their institution to do, because their model just doesn't support that. So we think there's some real possibilities of some good things coming out of the executive order to benefit the whole industry. Some folks may be familiar enough with it that the executive order really called out for these regulatory changes to be focused on small originators and small financial institutions, small players in the marketplace. And we actually think that that's a misnomer, that rule changes should be broad-based and should be for the benefit of the entire industry. Otherwise, you wind up running split tech stacks. You wind up with a lot of different costs and expense. The standardization up and down that we have today actually is helpful in lowering costs to originate a loan and not counter. So having multiple sets of rules is not generally the best way to create efficiency and cost savings.
Agreed. No, that makes sense. Just historically, I think really what we're talking about here is there was a ton of regulation that went into place after the Great Financial Crisis, right? And that was done for a lot of good reasons, but it was kind of very high level, very stiff guardrails. So what we've been dealing with the subsequent 20 plus years, and including right now with these executive orders, is trying to put a little more common sense into, you could call it loosening or just sort of modernizing some of those rules and allowing there to be some flexibility in there. Is that basically the gist of it?
I would say so. It's lightening it up and loosening it up a little bit to make it a little less onerous, have fewer gotchas. That is something from an examination perspective. you know, when you're dealing with these examiners, the regulatory agencies, there's always so many gotchas that are out there. And it depends on the, I'll say, the jerkness of the examiner, whether they want to pull out the gotcha cards or not. And if they do, there's really not much you can do about it. So that forces us to act in a way that ultimately increase costs for families to buy homes, because we have to charge them more because we're either paying for outside compliance services, we're paying for fee generation engines, we're paying for other services in order to avoid the gotchas. And as an industry, all of that expense gets pushed on to the families that are buying homes. And it's just how it works.
It has to be. Yeah, the overhead of regulatory compliance since Dodd-Frank has been well documented, and is the reason why one of the reasons a lot of mortgage companies didn't make it. Like, obviously there was the putbacks and the bad loans and all that from pre-2007, but then from there it was the regulatory burden was just huge. You had to have inside counsel, you had to spend thousands of dollars per loan just to remain within those guardrails and survive those audits. So yeah, it makes sense to put some common sense to it now, 20 years later.
Yeah. Yeah, it's amazing that we're approaching 20 years post. I mean, things started to go bad in 2007, and that really ramped up in 2008 from a financial crisis standpoint. And here we are 18 years later in 2026.
So something else I want to cover, I want to be sure we get to here, is the housing bill, the affordability bill that's been bouncing its way through the chambers, through kind of the typical bureaucracy of our government. You know, there's a Democrat version, there's a Republican version now. I believe the Republican version is in the House, kind of stalled in terms of voting. We've talked about it a bit on our webinars. I don't know that we've talked about it much on this podcast, but what are some takeaways for this group when paying attention to the Road to Housing Act?
Yeah, the 21st Century Road to Housing Act. Right now, the two competing bills that are out there that are the biggest issue is the House has passed a version and the Senate has passed a version, but they are not the same. So without having a full-on conference to get those onto the same page, which they haven't done a full-on conference, I heard a few weeks ago, it was like 2010 or 2011 was the last time we had a true full House Senate conference committee. So it's like a lot of these people don't even know how to do that anymore. Mm-hmm. So they have to revise these bills so that way they match. So there's going to be some horse trading between the two chambers to get that done. And from a housing standpoint, there's lots of good that's in these bills, whether it's some provisions for modernizing the rural housing service, you know, USDA's rural housing, to all kinds of cleanup items that are out there that are just good to do and should be done anyway from a modernization, including updates to manufactured housing, significant updates to manufactured housing as far as what's eligible, what's not eligible, removing some of the more dated requirements around fixed chassis and other things that are out there. Some of those provisions are good. It may blur the lines a little bit between manufactured housing and modular housing, and we could do a whole program just probably devoted to the differences between those two products in the marketplace, because they are different. To the casual observer, they're the same. But modernizing manufactured housing is going to be good. That can be part of how we fix some of these housing issues in the country. But one of the other things that's in Road to Housing that's got to get fixed between the two bills is the Senate bill has a drafting error as it relates to multifamily housing lending limits for the GSEs. And the intent was to change the lending limits and put on a reasonable escalator. So they're like 1-4 family, where every year we wait in November with bated breath for the new limits to come out. Something similar for that to happen for multifamily. The Senate bill has a drafting error, and the limit actually would be lower after passage and not higher. And it hasn't been updated since the early 2000s. So that's got to get fixed between the two bills.
Indeed.
The other big one that's in there that the industry has to think through is what's called the institutional investor ban. This is a topic that is pretty hot right now. The president has made discussions and made speeches on wanting to ban institutional investors. I believe he actually signed an executive order stating such. This is a two-sided coin. As housing values rise, the thought that you have large institutional investors that are buying homes and ultimately driving home values up further is pretty hard to take, especially if you're a family trying to get into a home and you can't afford one. So banning institutional investors can make a lot of sense in that regard. But the other side has to be considered in this. In the post-2008 crisis, we saw areas of the country, and I'm just proximate enough to Jim in the Front Range in Colorado to have watched this happen, where housing values started to crater. And as they started to crater, what put a floor underneath housing values? Large institutional investors that said, these assets are too cheap and we're going to step in and prop the housing market up and buy them. Most all of those homes were turned into rental homes very quickly. And then over a 4 to 5 year period, a lot of those institutional investors divested of those properties and they're now in the hands of general homeowners. So while you may like the idea around banning institutional investors to stop values from skyrocketing, and I think all of us would like to find ways to stop values from skyrocketing, you run the risk of pulling away a piece of market support from the industry should values start to decline. And we never know when we're going to have a market event that creates that housing decline. But should we get a large correction like we had post-2008, without the institutional investors, it could be a problem. I would just encourage everybody to kind of think through both sides of the coin before you pick whether you're going to support the institutional investor ban or not support the institutional investor ban, because there's broader implications.
That's a super important point with that discussion. You know, it cannot be a simple black and white scenario, and you've pinpointed exactly why. And it makes me wonder about just a lot of the moves that are being made. We live in this kind of boom and bust economy, for better or for worse, right? And we're often addressing one side of that scenario, right? And right now, we seem to be doing a lot of things to slow the appreciation of homes in a market where it's kind of happening on its own. And some of these things are things that will be difficult to take back, like an institutional investor ban, right? Right. We find ourselves 5 years from now in a cratering market saying, oh man, I wish somebody, you know, deep pockets that have more of a tolerance for risk and market exposure would come in and put a floor under some of these houses that are likely to be in some of the more underserved areas. I would imagine that's kind of what happened last time around, right? Lower cost housing, newer builds, condominiums, this sort of demographic. Meanwhile, we're doing so much to increase supply. Could we find ourselves in a situation where we've created another scenario where we have a housing bust? Hard to say, but you make a good argument for why we should be closely considering the long term impacts of this ban versus just saying the pitchforks are out and it's the big banks that are kind of ruining everyone's chances of buying a home right now.
Yeah, and Jim, I would even say I wouldn't worry about it so much in 5 years, because the institutional investors will have long tenured folks that understand home, 1 to 4 family real estate investments, the risks, the returns, the rewards that go with that in 5 years. That institutional knowledge will still be there. I get concerned about when you're 18 years from now, like we're 18 years post-financial crisis, and all of those people that had that experience and would be able to make that call, even if there was no ban, are no longer employed because they're all retired. They've moved on. It's been 20 years since we've done it. Now we can't even play, even if we get the green light to do it, because we're not sure how do we manage the risks associated with it. How do we actually run this play and make it make sense for the large investors? Because you've pulled the whole infrastructure out from underneath of it.
It's not an industry anymore. Yeah.
Correct.
That makes it even more interesting.
So 5 years, you could potentially flip that on a dime and still get it back or some form of it back.
Right. By necessity.
If it's 20 years out, it's not coming back.
We've forgotten how to move that muscle.
Right.
Yeah.
So, you know, I'm personally very leery about it. I'm not saying no, but I'm definitely not saying yes.
Right. I mean, the home builders are against it. The NBA, I believe, is generally against it.
Right.
Obviously, institutions who you know buy homes are against it, but otherwise has a lot of support on you know both sides of the aisle. And the rest of the bill, though, generally bipartisan, right? Generally likely to pass in some form here in the coming months. Very rare situation where there is, you know, universal support for the other things that are going on with the bill, such as just general deregulation around certain types of housing, making it easier to and faster to bring affordable homes to market, right? Which is something I think we all believe we've been missing over the last 5 to 10 years. So I don't know, optimistic that it comes out one way or the other. Obviously the institutional home buyer ban is at issue. So is, I believe the president has also attached a couple of conditions to signing the bill into law eventually that are around things that have nothing to do with housing, which is kind of always a thing, but I believe they're around election reform is one of the things that may or may not make it into the final bill.
Yeah, the president has been pretty firm that he doesn't want to sign anything without the election reform bill and without funding the Department of Homeland Security. So, you know, even though you've got in the Senate, the current version of Road to Housing in the Senate passed 89 to 10, there are potential stumbling blocks to getting it done.
Mm-hmm. All right. So, yeah, that's one. Keep your eyes on the news there, everybody. Because something will happen there. And, you know, I think this kind of news gets overshadowed by a lot of the geopolitics going on in the world. But this is a pretty important one. Long term, this should be exactly what could be needed for just improvement in this, on the supply side. And so just the lowering of costs, again, for borrowers, just making some of this stuff easier to get done. All right. What else do we have, Alex? Does that cover us?
I wanted to ask Jeremy what stumbling blocks he might see. And I think he answered it perfectly in regards to the institutional investors there. I guess I'll ask the flip of that question, Jeremy. What do you think has the potential to be the most effective, most in regards to changer. National housing policy? Yeah. Yeah. The game changer.
I think the biggest misnomer in the housing market and in the housing industry is that we can fix a local regional issue with national policy. So lack of housing supply was universal during the pandemic because we had so much demand. We are 5 years post-pandemic or approaching 5 years post-pandemic. And the demand structure shifted. And now housing has moved back to more of its historical local regional flair. So you have markets like Austin, you have markets like Denver that are maybe approaching overbuilt. You have markets like Omaha that are not. You know, the Northeast has created so many barriers to building that they're not overbuilt, and it is very difficult to become overbuilt there because it's difficult to build a house. So they're not seeing softening in housing values the way some of these markets that are maybe overbuilt are. Florida is starting to become overbuilt as a state. There's still pockets within markets. So to really think that we're going to fix a local regional problem with national policy is really short-sighted, and it doesn't reflect reality. The reality is the national policy changes can make it easier for the local markets to self-help and make it easier for the local markets to flourish because they're not putting artificial limiters on them. But in and of itself, a lot of what we're trying to do with Road to Housing or the Housing Executive Order, they're secondary things when it comes to creating more supply and creating more homes for families. It's really the local, state, local, regional is where the rubber meets the road, to the most part. And that's where the local lenders, the local real estate agents, the local people, the building community have to be engaged with cities, counties, states in order to make the changes necessary to make it make sense for their area. I just don't know any other way out of it because it's a local problem that was exacerbated during the pandemic and created a national campaign.
Right. Absolutely. No, I like that answer. I like that answer. It's it won't fix it potentially, but no, thank you.
It can't hurt. It won't fix it, but it won't hurt.
Right. And it creates the framework, right? Like it's to your point, regulations around building codes is all local, at least at the state level, likely at the municipal, you know, the municipality level. So the way it was explained to me, some of this road to housing bill, especially, is that the federal government could sort of hand down a framework to build a neighborhood, for instance. This is how this neighborhood could be built. If you fall within these guidelines, this is kind of can be universally accepted across the states. And you can, versus what happens now, which is anytime you want to build a new development, you have to start on square one and you have to take however many months or years it takes to get all the approvals for the type of neighborhood you're building and the sewage, the electric, and the building codes. This says, here's just what, if you do it this way, the municipality should sign off on it. So there needs to be some either nationwide adoption of these codes, or there's also been an argument that there could be some incentives handed down by the federal government, whether it's a carrot or a stick, right? Could be, you know, could be withholding highway money, which has been done in the past, to say, if you don't conform to these new codes, then we're going to withhold highway dollars. Or there could be other things where they could say, we're going to subsidize such and such a program if you adopt these programs, just to kind of get those incentives out there. But to your point, it's just a framework at this point. It needs to be adopted at the state and municipal level.
Right. And rightly so, to an extent, from the standpoint of, I would expect the energy code and insulation requirements to be extremely different between, you know, Grand Forks, North Dakota, and
Florida,
you know, Tucson, Arizona.
Yeah.
You know, you don't have to build those properties the same way, but there are aspects of those properties that absolutely should be built the same way. So, you know, it's a lot more nuanced than we necessarily want to give it credit for, because it's an extremely complex system. To a large degree, it's kind of like an umbrella or like a balloon. When you squeeze it, it starts to pop out someplace else. You're not exactly sure where you're squeezing all the time.
Right. That's a good point. Good. Another good analogy. All right. Well, that's probably as good a point as any to end this on. Jeremy, very much appreciate you being on, sir. This is very informative for me. Hopefully it was for everybody out there. Again, there's a lot of things going on right now on the Capitol Hill that affect our industry, and not all of them are getting a ton of press, but they all are super important. And it feels like there's a deluge of decisions that'll be made here in the coming months that are going to affect us for years to come. So thanks for educating us on that and having this discussion.
No, I appreciate the invitation and you guys giving me a little bit of a platform to talk a little bit about a few things that I've got my eyes on these days.
Very good. Very good. Glad we could help each other out and have this open, kind of candid discussion. So we'll do it again soon. And again, thanks, Jeremy, for the wisdom. Thanks, Alex.
Thanks,
Jeremy. Take care, gentlemen. All right, let's close this thing out. Thanks so much, James, Alex, and Jeremy. That's it for today. Join us next week for another episode of Optimal Insights, where we'll continue to provide you with the latest market analysis and insights to help you stay ahead. Check out our full videos on YouTube. You can also find each episode on all major podcast platforms. Thanks again for tuning into Optimal Insights.